Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do modern humans eat that our ancestors did not? We've all heard the warnings about the dangers of 21st century processed foods, and it is true that many of the things we do today to natural products makes them less nutritious than they might otherwise be. But there is one type of processing that tends to have the opposite effect, allowing us to take in more nutrients in a sitting and greatly reducing our exposure to foodborne illness. The advent of cooking, my guest today will tell us, forever changed the human race, not just physically, but culturally, and it may have begun tens of thousands of years sooner than previously believed. Richard Wrangham is Ruth Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard University. His new book is called Catching Fire: How Cooking Made Us Human. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with this. How and when do you think humans discovered fire?
I think that we can trace the control of fire back to 1.8 or 1.9 million years ago, because that is the time when we first see humans having the small teeth and evidence of the small guts that are characteristic of a species that was cooking.
So without the big teeth and a big gut, it would be really hard to survive in the conditions that, early humans lived in.
That's one of the astonishing things that I've learned over the last few years. You know, we've often assumed that because humans are animals and animals eat their food raw, so humans should be able to do so too. And obviously we can eat lots of things raw. But the question is, could we in practice, in the wild, survive on a raw diet? And everything that I have learned suggests that that is not possible, because we just don't extract enough of nutrient value from our raw food.
I was amazed to read how much time that our ancestors spent every day just chewing what it was they were taking in.
Yes, it's amazing. I mean, I've often had the experience of taking a film crew to go and watch chimpanzees in the wild, and they're expecting them to be sort of rather like humans, of spending only a little time eating and the rest of the time doing interesting things. But actually, chimps are really pretty boring. They spend about half their time simply chewing. And if we were a great ape, to judge from studies of gorillas and orangutans and chimpanzees and so on, then we would be spending about that time chewing. But because we cook and our food is so soft, we've freed up a tremendous number of hours per day.
You actually tried this for a while. You lived and ate as a chimp. Can you talk about what happened?
Well, I mean, for a while is really a bit of an exaggeration, because I gave up pretty darn soon. I used to follow chimpanzees. I still do, but from nest to nest, from dawn till dusk, and I would sometimes go without any food with me, hoping to simply rely on what the chimpanzees ate, and I would do that. But I pretty rapidly discovered that it is not a way to live, because the foods that the chimpanzees eat are, well, strong-tasting is a kind of polite way to put it. They're very fibrous, they're very dry, they taste very nasty, a lot of them. And it's only rarely that they find a tree that has the kinds of fruits that you and I could really imagine eating a meal of. I mean, it hardly ever happens. So what happens to a human trying to do this? You get hungry. You get very, very hungry. And you realize that we couldn't eat that way.
So at this point, 1.8 million years ago, when we apparently discovered fire and started cooking foods and our bodies started to change, before that time, women may obviously have cared for young infants, but they didn't necessarily sort of stick around camp all day.
Well, that's right. Humans are unique among every other species of animal because of our sexual division of labor. And people often say, well, you know, what's special about humans is that men go out and get meat, and they give that to the females and the children. But you know what is even more special than that, which actually is something very similar to what lots of birds and various other animals do, but what's really special about humans is that the females feed the males. That, you know, our females go and get roots or fruits or seeds or whatever it is, and then cook them, and the husband comes back and can be very confident that he will have a meal in the evening. So that's really special about humans, and it seems quite unlikely that that happened before we started cooking.
Why was it that humans, I guess, was it only the greater physical strength of the men? Was that why we decided that the men would go out and hunt and the women would stay back and cook?
I do think that there is something in simply the physical ability of men to bully women into giving them food that lies at the heart of this arrangement. And the idea is this, that once you start cooking, then it is simply mandatory to have a certain amount of food sitting there waiting while it improves. So if you've got hungry young men who have been wasting their time by day and haven't satisfied their food needs, then it's easy for them to, as it were, prey on individuals who haven't got some system of protection. And so women would have been vulnerable simply to the physical bullying of men who are bigger and have got greater upper body strength. But a lot of that would have come from the fact that the men would have been in groups. You know, I mean, even now we have records in small-scale society of boys getting into little gangs and going around and kind of terrorizing the camps, rustling food, as it were, from people who haven't got a sufficient sort of system of protection for them.
The other thing that fire really allowed us to do was to sort of sleep around this space that was warm. Can you talk about how that started to change the way we formed society?
Well, you're absolutely right. And we all think of fire as a tremendous source of comfort, and we love to sort of relax around a fire. But one of the reasons that we are able to do that is because we are a relatively relaxed kind of species. You know, we have pretty calm temperaments that allow us to spend a lot of time close to other individuals and not fearing that they're going to be losing their tempers very easily. But this is not true of chimpanzees, the species that I know best. And in a sense, what we have in the human temperament is something much more like a domesticated animal, much more like a domesticated dog than a wolf, or a domesticated cat than a wild cat. And I think it's easy to imagine that as we were all drawn to the tremendous benefits of a fire, be they the warmth, but also, of course, the source of food, then there would have been evolution through natural selection of a new kind of psychology, where instead of being very much sort of independent souls who lost their temper very quickly, we would now be, there would be favoring of calmer individuals who relatively easily reconciled and were comfortable socially together. The fire brought us into a new kind of society.
So in the sense that we would banish those who sort of didn't follow those rules and behave themselves, we domesticated ourselves.
Yes, I think that is a reasonable way to put it. I mean, it's a bit like the way people think about dogs nowadays. I mean, there's still a bit of a debate, but Ray and Lorna Carpenter have got this wonderful concept of the way that dogs became domesticated around 14,000, 15,000 years ago, and it was because at that time humans were settled for the first time, and so the ur-dog, the original dog, which would have been a wolf, were attracted to the settlements and wanted to get the food, and the ones who were calmest, least aggressive, tamest, most domesticated, were the ones who were able to get the most food. And so this attraction of wolves to the settled resources provided by humans about 15,000 years ago is a kind of model for what would have happened were humans attracted to fire almost 2 million years ago.
One thing that the book does, Richard, is remind us how much energy it takes just to digest food. Can you talk about that for a minute?
It's astonishing, isn't it? The guts are hidden so deep in our body that we don't have a very good physiological understanding of them. But actually, there's lots of evidence now from humans and all sorts of different animals that in order to be able to do the physical and chemical work to process food within our guts, you have to pay substantial cost. Now, that cost is affected by all sorts of things, but in humans, it typically probably is around 10% of the value of the food, but it's higher for other things. It's higher for some foods than others. It's higher for protein than it is for carbohydrate. in some animals, they can pay as much as 40% of the cost of the food to be able to digest it. And the significance of this is that merely by knowing the chemical concentration of the items in your food, you don't necessarily know how much it's going to be worth to you, because the physical packaging matters tremendously. If you have softer foods, if you have foods that are relatively easy for the body to be able to digest simply because of their physical nature, such as being very small particles, then you save a lot of energy in the digestion, and the net result is you get more calories out of it, and, well, you'll get fatter.
You write that cooking effectively allows the work of digestion to begin outside the body. What changes, remind us, when we cook food?
Well, there are a number of things, and we still have an incomplete idea, but here are a couple. If you're eating meat, then meat, of course, is not just a solution of protein. It's the proteins of muscle fibers wrapped in bundles of collagen, the connective tissue, the white stuff that makes meat tough. Now, if you cook, and particularly if you're a good cook and you do it well, then you succeed in essentially melting the connective tissue. You dissolve it, and it becomes jelly. It is it becomes gelatin. So that converts all of this collagen and connective tissue, which is has got the tensile strength of aluminum, into jelly, and now suddenly it's very much easier to eat. So that's one very important area. Here's another one, starch. Starch in plants comes in little granules, tiny things that you can barely feel even with your tongue, although you can just feel them that way. If you don't cook, if you eat your food raw, those starch granules are quite difficult to digest. They're condensed little packages that it is got a high chance of going through your gut without even being digested at all. But cook them, they heat up, they gelatinize, they open up, and the molecules of amylopectin and amylose, the key sugar-bearing parts of those starch granules, now become easily accessible to amylase. And so you can shift the digestibility from around 50% to almost 100% simply by cooking.
And digesting more food also fed our bigger brains, which are also a huge drain on the food that we eat.
It's been discovered recently that brains occupy a very special place in our bodies because they are so hungry. I mean, our brains weigh something like a 40th of our body, but consume about a fifth of our energy requirements when we're asleep. And so you need to find a way to supply energy to brains if you're going to have and evolve a big brain. And it certainly seems, as you say, as though one of the consequences of cooking is that it enables us to fuel our big brains. And there's a sort of interesting quirk in the way this happens. And the quirk is this, that when we are asleep, say, and we just have to maintain all the organs in our body, we don't have extra energy just to divert to our brains unless we can reduce the amount of energy we give to some other organ in the body. And there is lots of evidence that the smaller that the gut is, then obviously the less the gut costs to maintain, because it has to be given blood all the time. And so the smaller guts allow you to put energy somewhere else. And in the primate order to which humans belong, the typical pattern is species with small guts end up with bigger brains because they can fuel those brains. And in the case of humans, we have the smallest guts in relationship to our body size of any of the species of primates, and we have the biggest brains. And it seems as though we have diverted that spared energy from the guts as a result of being able to cook into our brains.
Richard Wrangham is with us. His new book is called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. You can join us in a moment at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Wrangham. He is Ruth Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard. His new book is called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Do you think that our ancestors, Richard, started cooking grains and vegetables around the same time they started cooking meat?
Yes, I think so. It's very likely that as soon as our ancestors discovered the merits of cooking, they applied it to everything they tried. And the reason I say that is because as we look at different species of animals nowadays, they all seem to prefer their food cooked if they can get it. We've tested chimpanzees and other apes on whether or not they like beef cooked. They do. But they also like potatoes cooked. It seems very likely that once they got to that critical moment, which, of course, we can only speculate how they did it, of being able to put their food against a fire and heat it up, then they would have done it with everything they had, because whether it's meat or whether it's veg, they get great benefits.
Is there any evidence that they also recognized early on that they were less likely to get sick from food that had been thoroughly cooked?
That's a fascinating question about the sort of medical aspects. There's no direct evidence on that at all. We do know that chimpanzees are able to self-medicate themselves a little bit, and it's reasonable to imagine that they would have been smart enough, those ancestors of ours, to be able to think a little bit about the medical aspects. But there's nothing that we can get at directly to say that they were getting those advantages. But remember that probably in many ways the biggest medical advantage would have been simply the fact that getting more energy, they'd have had more energy for their immune system, and therefore they'd have been just better able to protect themselves from disease. And we think nowadays that meat is very dangerous if it's eaten raw, and that's right. But, of course, part of that is because it's been processed so much and it's been chopped up and there's been an opportunity for bacteria to grow on it. But if you eat the raw meat of a wild animal shortly after it's been killed, there's going to be very, very low toxin loads on it.
What do we know about how often early humans ate once they had cooking available to them?
Well, once the ancestors cooked often enough to be able to evolutionarily adapt to cooking, then they had to be committed to it, because just as nowadays with our small mouths and small guts, we cannot survive well on raw food, the same would have been true for our early ancestors. And we see it around 1.8, 1.9 million years ago, the evolution of these features of small mouths and small guts that surely indicated a real commitment to a high quality of food, which must have been produced by cooking. At that point, they might have had a day or two at a time when they were eating raw food, but basically they had to eat cooked food on a very regular basis to be able to survive. So I think that once it got going, it became a completely regular feature of their lives.
So suddenly we have smaller guts and smaller jaws but bigger brains. Did we trade some physical stamina for these improvements?
Well, the thing we lost was the ability to survive on raw food. Physical stamina, it may have actually been the opposite, because we were getting more energy from the food that we did eat as a result of cooking. And if we now compare ourselves with chimpanzees, which are always the best sort of touchstone in this kind of example, it's actually rather striking. Chimps are extremely strong in the short term. That is to say, they can pull a rope and exert a force maybe three or four times as strong as a human. But if you go for a long walk, a chimp gets exhausted before you do. I mean, I have followed chimpanzees for I think the longest I've ever followed one on a single day was just over 10 kilometers, maybe 6 or 7 miles. And those chimps who did that, there were three of them, and they were completely exhausted the next day, and they only went about 200 or 300 yards before they went back into their nest and slept. So in terms of real stamina to keep going for many hours, humans are able to do it much better than other apes. And that's probably partly because of our energy supply and partly because our bodies have been redesigned.
Yeah, one way that they were redesigned is that we're not covered with hair anymore, at least most of us.
Yes, that's right. Now the question of why we are the naked ape has been exercising people for years, of course. And often people have thought about the fact that it enables us to lose heat relatively rapidly during the day under the influence of a hot sun. And this means that we can be a bit unusual in being a predator that goes out in the hot sun when other animals tend to be resting because they don't want to acquire too much heat, and gives us an advantage in being able to kill them, for instance. Well, one of the components of that argument is has been missing up until now, which is, how is it that we manage to be able to stay warm at night? Because that's when you really need the hair, when you're asleep, when your body is not producing its own heat through work. Well, the answer, of course, is that once we were cooking, that meant that we were controlling fire. That means that we were able to be warm at night, and that is probably what actually allowed us to lose heat and therefore become more effective hunters.
Richard Wrangham is my guest. His new book is called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Crispin in Dallas, who has a question about something that I know you're very passionate about, Richard. Your take on the raw food movement.
Oh, well, I think this is a really interesting area because the raw foodists, I think, have got onto something very good, which is that in many ways it's a very healthy diet. It's particularly a healthy diet if you are overweight, but it also can be a healthy diet for people who have some kind of inflammatory reaction to the products of cooked food, and if you just want to eat relatively lightly. The one thing I think the raw foodist movement has got wrong to some extent is that many of them argue that raw food is a natural diet for humans. Now that we know more and more about how humans fare on a raw food diet, it does not seem at all as though it is a natural diet. It may be a good diet under some circumstances. You've got to be careful with it because it can lead to some disadvantages like low bone mass, but it does not seem natural, even if for some people it is perfectly splendid.
So it was natural for us before we evolved into our current biological state.
Exactly. It was natural for us, you know, almost 2 million years ago, but that's a long time. You know, you can have many, many species evolving in turn in almost 2 million years. So everything was natural for us once. You know, at one point our ancestors were, I don't know, so something like fish. But in terms of our recent evolutionary past, then I think cooking has been an important component, not just for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, but for almost millions of years.
Do the dual roles of cooking and hunting explain why we're willing to share food when most other primates are not?
Sharing is quite complex, and you're right that surely it's got something to do both with meat eating and with cooking. In primates, they share mostly under pressure. That is to say that someone who's got some valuable item, like in the case of chimpanzees, a piece of meat, tends to escape with it if they can, and then if they are found with it, they either have to hand it over to someone who's socially dominant to them, or they will allow others to try and take little pieces of meat simply because when you're eating meat, you can't both eat it and stop others eating it at the same time. Well, so that's sharing under pressure. Now, humans, of course, don't exactly share under pressure in the sense of having someone's hand in your face at the time when you're trying to eat yourself. But I think one can argue that there is a sense in which it's sharing under pressure because it's all a consequence of social rules that are designed to suppress our tendency to try and grab food. But, I mean, the fact is that humans eat in an amazingly restrained and generous way compared to other species. The classic picture in my mind is the starving or the very hungry hunters and gatherers out on the African plains, where the woman produces the food in the evening, and three or four people sit around the fire, and everyone is completely restrained. They don't grab the food at all. They just wait to be shown that it is their turn to eat, or they all simultaneously take little pieces. They follow social rules to a really touching degree for people who are so much up against it. And this ultimately seems to derive from the fact that when you have these very valuable foods, you can't afford to have a social arrangement in which people just grab and fight over the food. And humans have evolved this wonderful tendency to share.
So early humans made this decision that the men would go out and hunt and the women would prepare the food and then they would all eat together. I'm curious, though, as to why that arrangement you think led to somewhat monogamous pairing as compared with sort of a community food sharing where everybody shared each other and their resources within the small group of 10 or 20 or 30 people.
Yeah, and it's a complicated situation, but the fact is that worldwide, in all of these small-scale hunter-gatherer societies and almost every society, actually, there is the household economy in which a woman produces food for a particular man, and a man produces meat for his wife or wives. Well, the argument that I produce in the book about how this happened fits with a lot of the social anthropological arguments, which is that, contrary to our first thought, these pair-bonded arrangements have got much less to do with sexual competition over reproduction and mating, than they have over the food itself. And here's the way the argument works. From a man's point of view, what he desperately needs in order to be able to hunt, in order to be able to do what men do, is to be guaranteed that when he comes home in the evening, he will get an evening meal. And that's what a wife does for him. Unless he has a wife, once his mother has died, he is unable to guarantee himself an evening meal. And the result would be that he has to spend his time behaving like a woman, going and getting some food and cooking it, and that's what bachelors sometimes do, and they end up hungry and thin because they juggle their time between doing that and doing manly things. So a man has huge advantages, and it's possible to read the story of small-scale society from a man's point of view as a way to get a guaranteed supply of food. One lovely example is that men in some of these societies, they very often marry, first of all, a woman who is quite old, often post-reproductive, and delighted to do so because she supplies him with food. Now, why does a woman enter into this arrangement? I think the argument that best accounts for this is that the household economy is kind of like a primitive protection racket in which a woman doesn't really get much advantage from it, except that she becomes party to a system of social rules that protects her and her products from being taken by anybody else. And the basic idea is that being married to a man, that man will protect her from the boys and the bachelors and the competitive women and so on who might want to take her food from her, because she can complain to him and he's a conduit to all of the other men in the society. And they will make a group decision that, yep, you know, whoever's doing this has to be punished to protect the wife.
You know, people today look at those very traditional sex roles and they seem remarkably antiquated. Is it fair, though, to argue that 1.8 million years ago and even more recently than that, this was necessary to sort of get the human race to where it is today?
Well, I think so. I mean, what you've got to imagine, it's certainly difficult to go back into the past, is that at the time that cooking began, it became hugely valuable from the point of view of the cooks. And so probably everybody wanted to get cooked food. But at the same time, it created a new social dynamic, this very difficult one, where you had to have a system of protection. Because when you cook, you can't eat the food straight away. You have to see it sitting there as it slowly improves in value to the point where it's ready to eat. And during that period, it can be stolen. And so essentially what cooking did was it created ownership. And therefore, it created the need for these social rules. Social rules that now seem sort of rather deep and obscure to us. But from the point of view of a relatively sort of primitive species, would have been absolutely vital to be able to take advantage of this wonderful new resource.
Do you have evidence that when food was quite scarce, that men would still come back and sort of bring home the bacon to the whole family?
When food is scarce, I'm not sure one can talk about a general pattern. I mean, in different hunter-gatherer societies, men sometimes, during periods of food scarcity, start behaving more like women and stop hunting and instead go off and gather roots because it's a bit more productive. And I think that illustrates the fact that hunting is rather a sort of luxurious activity. It produces this splendid food, meat, which is not predictable, but when you get it, it's absolutely wonderful. And the way in which society works is that hunting is really made possible by the productive activity of women, by the fact that they cook. It wouldn't be possible without cooking, because cooking softens food so much that you can eat it very quickly. That means that you can come back in the evening as a man and in an hour or so eat enough calories to satisfy you for the day. But if you were eating raw food, that wouldn't happen, and so you wouldn't be able to be supported to the point where you could spend lots and lots of time hunting.
Richard Wrangham is my guest. He's Ruth Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard University. His new book is called Catching Fire: How Cooking Made Us Human. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Richard Wrangham is my guest. He is Ruth Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard University. His new book is called Catching Fire: How Cooking Made Us Human. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Richard, why do you think, after having recognized the value of tools and of different kinds of things that we innovated in order to sort of improve our lot, why has it taken until now to understand the significance of cooking?
Yeah, it's remarkable, because we all know that you are what you eat. And when you think about humans, cooking really is the signature feature of our diets. There are constant little stories that such and such people rely on raw food or eat solely raw food, but they always turn out to be untrue. I think one of the very big reasons is that people have not appreciated just how biologically significant cooking is. You know, until recently, people have thought of cooking as a luxury. It gives us delicious smells, it makes food a little bit safer, but we could rely on raw food. But once you see that's not true, then you start realizing that whenever cooking evolved, it must have had just terrific effects. Here's another problem. The phenomenon of cooking obviously depends on the control of fire, and so you'd say, well, let's look back into the archaeological past and see what the archaeologists tell us about when fire was first controlled. And the difficulty here is that the indications until recently were that fire was first controlled sometime in the last 500,000 years. And if that is the case, then obviously cooking would have started during that period, but nothing happened to our evolutionary anatomy. Our bodies just didn't change at all. And so again, that suggested that cooking didn't do anything. It wasn't important. But now we realize that fire is probably much older than that period, and it's just that the archaeological record, it evaporates too quickly for us to learn when it was that fire actually was first controlled.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Carrollton and speak to Layla. Hi, Layla.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I was calling in regards to, of course, the show that's going on right now, but basically I was watching a show on the Discovery Channel, and they were talking about the major differences also between chimpanzees and humans. And the two most striking things that I found was, one, the ability of humans to share versus chimpanzees. Actually, chimpanzees are able to share as long as everybody has a piece, but it has been proven that humans, even from when they're babies, just baby borns within 1 and 3 years old, without giving them a reward for sharing, they are able to pass things to other humans without them getting any apparent benefit out of it, which kind of made me feel better about being a human to begin with. And second was the incredible spatial memory, and correct me if I'm wrong with the term, but basically one of the things why chimps and monkeys also swing around vines is because when they swing, they're able to look at the entire area and get a perfect picture of it, while we humans have lost this ability, if we believe in theory of evolution, of course, but I would like to see the comments of the gentleman on this matter.
Richard, does that apply?
Well, there's a great comment from Layla about human differences from primates in general. I mean, she's absolutely right, of course, about sharing, and it is fascinating the way that babies come predisposed in the world to look to see what adults or other individuals are doing, and to share what they have. So clearly, we have evolved from our chimpanzee-like ancestor, where that tendency is much less strong. Now, how much that comes directly from cooking or something else, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that probably it comes partly from the fact that we have language, and as a result of having language, we're able to all collaborate together much more effectively, so that anybody who fails to share is going to be subject to a sort of communal sanctions. But where exactly it comes from, hard to say, but a great observation that it is very important. And certainly, as we were speaking about earlier, the relationship between cooking and sharing is very strong. The food writer Michael Simon says, cooking is the starting place of all trades. He's got this wonderful poetic metaphor. He says, sources dispense goodness. It does seem likely that out of the social rules emerging around cooking are wonderful, generous, cooperative, sharing tendencies in humans have had a great base.
Layla also mentioned this idea that chimps seem to have a very good sense of spatial relations. I wonder if the larger brain helped us also in hunting, in that we were able to sort of navigate our way back, even if we'd gone several miles away from where home base was.
Yeah, there is some evidence that species that occupy relatively large areas in their daily lives do have bigger brains. Whether or not there is a causal relationship here is uncertain, but humans clearly are actually pretty good. I think Layla suggested that spatial memory is better in other primates, and it may be in certain ways, three-dimensionally in the trees. But in terms of just being able to navigate around the environment, humans are just as good, maybe better than other species. And that probably is related to our big brains. But it's easy to imagine this is just an incidental consequence, that once you've got a bigger brain as a consequence of being able to fuel it better and perhaps having it favored because of its advantages in giving you social intelligence, then other things happen as well, such as you can navigate better, and that means that you can go off maybe 2 or 3 days in one direction and on a hunting expedition and still find your way home.
Let's jump forward a couple million years and talk about how we eat right now. One thing that we don't tend to take into account when we are cooking food is its net caloric absorption. Start with this, if you would. How do we determine how many calories are in food, and why don't we apply the differences depending on whether it's raw or cooked?
It's quite difficult to devise a system for calculating the caloric value of food simply by looking at what's in the food. But the way we do it goes back to the system devised by Professor Atwater over 100 years ago. And what it involves is essentially looking at each of the components, and the major ones are carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, and calculating how much of those there are, and then assuming that the entire caloric value of those things is accessible to us in our bodies. Now, that assumption, it now turns out, is wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that depending on the way the food is packaged, we may or may not be able to take advantage of all the food that's there. And we spoke earlier about the fact that starch, when it's raw, is not digested in the same way as when it's cooked. But our food labeling system doesn't notice this. It gives just as many calories whether a food is raw or cooked, or whether it's in large particles or in small particles. So essentially, our food labeling system tells us what is the maximum amount of food calories we could get out of a food if we processed it to perfection. And what it doesn't tell us is how much we practically will get if we eat it in, say, its raw state. So amazingly, you know, you look on the USDA website and you find out how many calories there are in a piece of raw beef compared to cooked, and the answer is exactly the same. But that's wrong. We're being sold something that is really not true.
And I have to imagine that we absorb calories more easily from, say, a bag of Fritos than from an ear of whole corn.
Yes, and because of this, there is a real potential for understanding a contributor to today's health issues. I mean, during the last 100 years, since Mr. Atwater developed his convention that we still use today, the quality of food has greatly changed, and generally it's changed by becoming more and more heavily processed. The individual particles are finer, the cooking is more complete. And that means that we nowadays get more out of our food in terms of the net caloric gain than we would have done for the equivalent but less processed food 100 years ago. So there's a kind of a sneak addition of calories to our energy budgets that has not been accounted for by the food labeling system, by our normal way of counting calories. And so this could easily be an important contributor to the obesity crisis. Until we have a really much improved way of accounting for calories, we may continue to get more and more calories actually out of a food that supposedly has the same number of calories as it always did.
So are we more likely, do you think, to ultimately sort of have our bodies evolve to the current reality, at least in Western society, where there is plentiful food with a lot of calories? Or is there more hope, perhaps, that we will learn to permanently adjust our diets?
Well, the question of evolution, of course, depends on who is having more babies. And the current association of changing patterns of diet, I don't know how it's associated with the people who are having more babies and surviving better. It's very difficult to see evolutionary trends in such a short time slice as just, you know, a few generations. But the long haul, over the last 10,000 years, it does seem as though we have adapted to the increased quality of the food. Our teeth have become a little bit smaller. This may be part of a trend that involves our guts becoming a little bit smaller. We'll have to stick around for another few thousand years and find out.
Do you have any idea why human teeth tend to be so bad if they are not worked on all the time? This seems in some ways to be such a flaw.
Well, yes, of course, I think the standard answer to that is that we have increased amount of sugar in our diets nowadays as a result of all of the agricultural foods and the way we process them, and this provides opportunities for bacterial growth in a way that a more traditional diet would not have done. So we now expose ourselves to new influences that are in some ways bad for our health.
And what do you think is going to happen with the modern cultural shift away from traditional sex roles? Is that likely? And I know you said evolution is obviously hard to predict, but what do you think that portends for the next several millennia in terms of how we live and how our bodies might change?
Well, I do think there's something for sociologists to think about here because, I mean, of course, this isn't evolutionary so much as people responding with their sex roles to the influences of their diet. But if you take the view that many social anthropologists do and that I do, that our marriage systems have got really more to do with economic relationships between men and women than they have to do purely with sexual mate guarding and sexual romance, then the fact that men can easily feed themselves without relying on a woman and that women can produce food very quickly as a result of fast food and packaging does mean that there is reduced dependence on each other for the production of the nightly meal. And essentially what that says to me is that marriage becomes less important. And the changes in the marriage system that we see, I mean, with divorce becoming so much more common than it was 100 years ago and so on, would seem as much to do with the relative ability of men and women to feed themselves individually as it does to changing sexual mores.
In a minute or so we have left, I wonder if you can talk just briefly about how this idea first came to you. My understanding is that you were sort of inspired sitting at home in front of your own fireplace.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, for years earlier, I had been with chimpanzees, and I had tried to eat what chimpanzees ate and found it very difficult. And then one evening, I was sitting preparing a lecture on human evolution, and I was in front of my fireplace at home, and I just let my eyes dissolve into the fire, and I was thinking about how far back in time there would have been my ancestors lying around the fire. And as I dissolved further and further back in time, it was very hard for me to imagine that any of our ancestors who were truly human, all the way back to almost 2 million years ago, could ever have escaped the need to be around that fire, because I could not imagine that they would have had the digestive abilities to survive as I tried to do on that raw food. So essentially what I came to was the thought, we know that cooking evolved sometime. We know that it had huge effects. How come we haven't yet seen those effects?
Richard Wrangham's new book, I'm so sorry we're out of time, Richard, is called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. It has been a real pleasure, Richard. Thank you so much.
Chris, delightful to talk to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
It's a festive season in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Government eases up on all kinds of social restrictions and people party on the street.
And for now at least, even Iran's president can be publicly branded a dictator.
People would get into trouble if they criticized Islam itself. But beyond that, it's open season on the government.
I'm Steve Inskeep. Iran's election season on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning, 5 to 9 on KERA 90.1.
It's 12:59. You're listening to your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. In Tyler, it's K261 CW 100.1. We're at K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. It's 1 o'clock.
I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how the work-family balance is changing in America and why men are starting to feel more conflicted than women. The 2008 national study of the changing workforce suggests we have reached a tipping point in attitudes about traditional gender roles to the extent that 60% of respondents disagreed with the statement that men should earn the money while women care for the children. We'll talk to the president of the Families and Work Institute about those evolving ideas and how they're affecting ambitions on the job and activities in the home. Our conversation begins after the news from National Public Radio.